Okay, in honor of Tu B'Av, it's, you know, technically, I guess, Motzai Tu B'Av, but we still have the glow of Tu B'Av, one of the happiest days of the year. And it's a good opportunity to talk about some happy topics. And of course, you know, Tu B'Av is associated particularly with Shiduchim, so I thought we would talk a little bit about a topic related to Shiduchim. We circulated that we would talk about disclosure. I called it disclosure and not Lashon Hara. We've spoken in the past about Lashon Hara and Shiduchim. There will be some of that. I always like talking a little Lashon Hara, but disclosure is not primarily about Lashon Hara, or not only about Lashon Hara, because first and foremost, we would ideally want the disclosure to come from the parties themselves. Lashon Hara becomes a question when a third party is involved. So we'll talk about that also, maybe in a parallel way. And some of the issues are unique to a third party, so we'll have to mention that along the way. But some of the issues, many of the issues that we'll try to talk about, are equally relevant when Lashon Hara is not an issue, when we're talking to the individual who's directly involved. And the question is just when a person is presenting themselves for marriage, so what are they obligated to reveal about themselves, given that none of us are perfect, presumably. So when we are getting involved in such a potential lifetime commitment, so what is required that we make clear? And working off the premise, and this is a premise which has to be taken in proportion, and we'll come back to this point towards the end and say a little bit more about it, but working off the premise that there is some relationship between marriage and a business deal. And in the most blatant sense, you know that the Gemara tells us that the marriage act itself, the act of Kiddushin, is derived in terms of its mechanism from the purchase of land that we read about in Parshas Chayisara, Yalef Kicha Kicha Misdei Ephron, and therefore the act of Kiddushin is a kinyan in that sense. Now, we don't mean that to be understood, that there is actually a purchase going on. That's not the way we understand it, but the act of Kiddushin is an expression of seriousness, is an expression of commitment between the two. The halacha has the man express his seriousness towards the woman, which creates a binding halachic relationship, and that is done through a kinyan, and that's what the Gemara tells us is derived from Stei Ephron. So for that reason, the mechanisms are the same as a kinyan, and there is a certain external similarity to a business transaction. And also, consistent with the relationship to a business transaction, you have two people who are entering into an agreement, which requires that there is a understanding that is informed. So if there is a lack of informed understanding, so then there are implications. What are their implications? So at the extreme, there could be an invalid agreement. So theoretically, there could be a what we call a mekachtos. There could be an arrangement under false pretenses, which might go so far as to declare the marriage null and void. We're not going to get into that tonight, and that's something that really would only happen under very extreme circumstances, and only under the guidance and the declaration of poskim of the highest stature. But we're just mentioning that to highlight just how severe the implications could be when the lack of disclosure is of the highest form, when the misinformation or the lack of information, the lack of awareness going into the relationship is of such a profound degree that theoretically the relationship might be declared null and void. But even assuming that the threshold doesn't reach that level, which is a very high level, so there is very possibly a significant avera involved in entering into a relationship under false pretenses, and that it is similar to that which would be involved in entering into a business transaction under false pretenses, selling something for a price that it doesn't, that isn't actually justified, which is the avera that we call onah. So the prohibition of onah, or on a different level, possibly Gnevas Das, as applied to Shiduchim, is a significant concern. And moving beyond the technical, also just the simple reality that somebody may enter into a relationship where they are inflicting tremendous emotional anguish on the other party is very, very sobering. It is something that is of great concern, or should be of great concern. So therefore, the question of how much is one obligated to disclose when entering into a dating relationship where there is the consideration of a commitment to marriage is a very serious one. So that's a question that is applicable to the parties themselves in the context of a dating relationship. And then theoretically, there is also a question that is relating to a third party. Because if you're not the one dating, but you're asked about somebody who's in such a relationship, so then the question is, how much are you obligated, and how much are you permitted, really, how much are you obligated to reveal? And as we've talked about a little bit in the past, so just as there is a prohibition to say negative things that are not necessary, so equally important is the obligation to speak up when something is necessary. And the obligation of what we call toeles is a mandate, and I think we've quoted in the past from the Sefer Pesach Yeshuv on Aruch Chaim, is one of the Yonim in Vilna in the late 1800s, who wrote that everyone gets all worked up about the concern of not saying things you're not supposed to say, but you should be equally worked up about those who fail to say what you need to say, that if there's a potential harm that's about to happen to someone and you can prevent that harm by speaking up, so you're obligated to do so. And that is generally understood to be from the mandate of Lo Samad Al Dam Riecha, that just as the same pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim tells us that we shouldn't speak badly about others, that Lo Selech Rachel B'Amecha, the same pasuk balances that with Lo Samad Al Dam Riecha, that we can't stand idly by when somebody is at risk of harm, and that would include the risk of a relationship that is harmful to them. So therefore, one is obligated to speak up under those circumstances. So theoretically, that is a major concern, even though on the one hand, so something that is negative provokes a concern of Lashon Hara, even anything that is private, even if it's not necessarily an issue of somebody's character, but if it's just personal, so normally that would be included in a prohibition of Lashon Hara. But if it's information that is material to somebody else's well-being, so then that brings up this concern of toelis. So balancing that becomes a big concern. So that's an issue that's relevant particularly to a third party. So one issue that is very relevant to both, and that complicates the Lashon Hara issue tremendously, and the issue of toelis is relevant to so many Lashon Hara questions and makes them often incredibly complicated. But particularly when it comes to Shiduchim, there's a whole other element that complicates things in a additional way, as if you need things to be even more complicated, and that's the issue of timing. Because very often that's a consideration that many poskim note, that sometimes there are factors that need to be disclosed, but they don't have to necessarily be disclosed at the first moment, and that they can be disclosed at a certain point after the couple has had a chance to actually meet. And there's a language that many of the posts can have, that sometimes if you disclose something too early on, it's going to have a disproportionate impact, because the phrase that they have is that at an early stage, kol davar katan mekalkel, that any small thing is going to mess it up, is going to destroy the relationship, is going to set it off course, or is going to derail it, because the other party will say, why should I go out with anyone who's not perfect? I'm perfect, so why should I consider anybody who's not perfect? I'll just wait for all the perfect people out there. And rather, if you wait a little while, once they've had a chance to encounter each other as individuals and see the whole package, so then when they hear this information, they'll be able to take it in stride and see how it is contextualized with everything else, and they'll maybe interpret it as part of the larger picture, and that will be a more appropriate judgment. Of course, there are some things which are so major that it's not going to make a difference how the other factors come into place, and that should be revealed up front. But there are many things which are important to disclose, but still it will make a difference how it interacts with other factors, and the individual does deserve to be presented as a complete human being before having this other effect brought into the picture. So timing makes a big difference. So very often, that is a legitimate consideration, and it's a highly subjective one. So it's a decision that is affected by a lot of cultural factors. So there's too many variables to try to spell out here, but it's going to make a difference what kind of an issue it is. And that's itself a highly subjective question. But then also, it's going to be affected by the pace of dating. So in some cultures, how long it takes to get to seriousness and how long it takes to get to engagement and to marriage can be very quick, and in other cultures it can be a much longer process. And also it may vary within a given relationship, within a culture. So that's going to make a big difference as to when exactly this disclosure should happen. So that's a highly subjective assessment which may require rabbinic guidance. So that's a part of the whole question. And that very much complicates the role of the third party, because ideally the dating individual will disclose the information on their own, and that's certainly the ideal, as long as it can be done fully and in an appropriate context. So sometimes a third party will be asked, and they won't necessarily know whether the people themselves, the principal parties themselves, have some kind of a legitimate consideration as to when to reveal this, or whether that threshold has been reached yet or not. And they may end up interfering with that process. So that's also something that has to be handled with great sensitivity and discretion. And that's a part of the complicated considerations here. And we always try to live life by the yardstick of Yahavta L'Reicha Kamocha, of love your fellow as yourself. And that sounds wonderful, but that also is complicated, because even just acknowledging the fact that there are two parties here, both of whom you have an obligation of Yahavta L'Reicha Kamocha, so you can't discard one for the other. But even acknowledging that, so what exactly satisfies that standard of Yahavta L'Reicha Kamocha is not an easy question to answer. So even if you were to pick one side and say, okay, I'm going to worry about them first with my Yahavta L'Reicha Kamocha, so it's not clear what is in a person's best interest. To be given information prematurely can also not be in somebody's best interest, because very often you'll have a happily married couple where one party will say that I'm so grateful that I didn't know about a certain issue until a little bit later on, because I found out after I was able already to take it in stride, to take it in context of all the good things I knew about this person. And had I heard too early, so then I would have just been discouraged, and I wouldn't have agreed to go out in the first place, and I wouldn't have this wonderful marriage that I have now. So even just looking from the consideration of Yahavta L'Reicha Kamocha of any one individual, that won't necessarily dictate whether the right decision is full disclosure immediately or waiting a little bit longer until there's ability to have a greater context. So there are no easy answers to these questions. So this takes a lot of careful thought. And all we can do is try to mention some kolim and try to come to these situations with great care and honesty and sincerity, and indeed v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, with as much commitment and integrity as possible, and hope that a careful study of these principles will give us the proper conclusions. So that being said, so let's mention a few of these principles. So the Chafetz Chaim mentions a couple of fundamentals. So he says anything that is a huge kind of principle, a huge kind of concern that you can assume that people will take very seriously, so that's the kind of thing that has to be mentioned up front. And he mentions there major spiritual issues or major medical issues. And he also says there that there are certain things that are not included in that. And that's itself interesting. The examples that he gives are interesting. They may or may not be relatable to us. And we don't necessarily have to focus on his examples specifically. Rather, we can try to extrapolate from his examples and apply them to our context in ways that are maybe a little bit more relatable. But for one example he gives as something that he would not volunteer. Here he's talking about what you would volunteer even if you're not asked. So let's say if you're a third party, so would you offer this information? So he says he wouldn't offer. To give an example of something he wouldn't offer, let's say a person isn't so sophisticated and he doesn't necessarily catch on to people's tricks. So you personally are not so impressed by that. But the person asking you has not indicated that that's an important quality for them that they're looking for in a spouse. So the Chafetz Chaim says you shouldn't necessarily volunteer that, because even if that's something that you care about, but you don't have a reason to think that that's necessarily what they care about. So therefore, he writes that that's the kind of thing you wouldn't volunteer unless you were specifically asked. And that's itself a very useful guide. So he draws this distinction between the kind of things that one can assume that most people in general would consider to be a objectively big deal, and the kind of things that are subjectively considerations that you may personally have a preference for, but if you are not the party involved and they're not asking directly about that, so then that's not something that you should volunteer. As I've commented in the past, I think that also includes your personal assessment of whether personalities match, because we don't really have a way to know that. And the current trend of yeshiva students to decide that they can tell whether two personalities will hit it off, and more likely to cast judgment in the negative sense and say, I don't see it, it's not shaykh, I don't see them getting along, and therefore to apostle a relationship just based on their sense of nevuah, apparently, to be able to tell whether they're going to get along or not. So that does a lot of harm, and I think that that is very squarely in the Chafetz Chaim's category here of something that one's not supposed to volunteer, because you have no way of knowing that. If they actually are completely incompatible for genuine reasons, if they have conflicting life values, so then to say they're not going to get along, so then there's a basis for that. But because you don't necessarily see how their personalities are going to mesh, so that's not something that we're able to predict. And very often couples have had very happy relationships that others have not been able to foresee. And you can do a lot of damage by trying to assess that on your own. And that's the kind of thing the Chafetz Chaim is saying one shouldn't volunteer, as far as I understand it. I would say that I think that's also true in terms of a third party's assessment of how attractive somebody is. As important as that is for the couple to feel attraction to each other, it's not a third person's role to assess whether that'll happen or not. That's something that is completely subjective. And for somebody to say that that's not a possibility based on their own opinion, I think that that is textbook Lashon Hara. That's completely subjective, and it's very harmful. That creates a predisposition on the part of that individual to think that it's not a possibility, and that's something which is the definition of Lashon Hara. It's something that is not objectively true and creates great unnecessary harm, and that certainly is a prohibition, you know, in the positive sense. So we know the Gemara in Ksubis, we know from all the weddings, the Gemara in Ksubis says that the view of Beis Hillel is, we say, Kalana v'chasuda, so to say it positively is a different story. And I think you could maybe actually derive from that, that's part of the point, that, you know, we know that Beis Shammai objected and said, how could we just say that that's the policy across the board, to say Kalana v'chasuda? Maybe you don't think it's true, and why shouldn't we worry about Midvar Sheker Tirchak? And we find that Beis Hillel's response is that we don't take that attitude, and we say that the Olam Yehidaito Shaladam Urevis and Mabrios, a person should always have the kind of attitude that makes him able to get along with people, which is an interesting way of responding here. But I think you could actually ask two questions here. You could ask maybe Beis Shammai's question, but you could also ask, why is it that this is the midah that we focus on? There are so many more important things to talk about at a wedding, to praise one spouse to the other, and you could focus on so many more important midos. Why do we talk specifically Kalana v'chasuda? And maybe you could suggest that the answer is that here you're talking about something which is completely subjective, and if you convince the chassan that this is a kalana v'chasuda, so there's no chance that you're wrong. And you'll contribute to his appreciation of her in a way that will be very helpful to their relationship. And it's the inverse of what we're saying here, that if you're going to express your opinion negatively, so then that has its own reality just because you're saying so, and that will hurt their relationship. And that's the actual isser of Lashon Hara. So the Gemara is telling us you can make a positive contribution by saying something nice in this area, and there's no harm that you're misleading them. If you're going to say the person is very righteous, the person never gets angry, the person is very God-fearing, so then there's a chance it might not be true and you might be misleading them. But if you say Kalana v'chasuda, she's a beautiful bride, so then there's no chance that that's wrong, because if you convince the husband that it's true, then objectively it's true, and there's no chance of you doing anything harmful. And the believer of Palm commented about that statement, that the whole idea, part of the whole broader theme of the mitzvah of Simchas Chasen Mekala, which is a fascinating chesed in general, because most of the mitzvahs of chesed that we have are there to help people out in a bad situation. You have somebody who's suffering in some way, a person, you have the mitzvah to visit the sick or to comfort mourners or to feed the hungry. So people who are suffering, you have a chesed to help them. While the mitzvah of Simchas Chasen and Kala, you have somebody who's already happy, and you have a mitzvah to make them happier. It's an unusual kind of chesed. So there are various explanations as to why this is, and I think Rav Palm explained that this is to create a reserve, that sometime after the wedding it's going to happen, that there's going to be a fight, and it's going to create a tension, and it'll help if, at that moment, when they're having a stress, that they can remember that sometime not so long ago, there was a evening when all of their friends got together and told them, you're the luckiest person in the world. Kalana v'chasuda, this is the greatest shidduch ever. You're the luckiest person. So having that reserve is very valuable to create a buffer zone against whatever tensions are going to come later on. So once again, you could also understand the opposite, that if you say something that is unwarranted, that is not an actual objective fact, so it could do most obvious kind of harm in terms of stopping a relationship from happening that could have happened. But it could also do less obvious, less direct kind of harm, because maybe the relationship will happen, but maybe it'll still have a subconscious effect that later on, when there is a tension of some kind, when there's a fight, then they'll remember, oh yeah, you know, they told me about you that you're whatever. They told me about you that it wasn't shaykh, that we wouldn't get along, etc. cetera, et cetera. And that's going to have a very negative effect, even if it doesn't earlier have the impact of stopping the relationship from happening. So that's real Lashon Hara, and that's something to really worry about. And that's, I think, what the Chafetz Chaim is talking about in terms of things that shouldn't be volunteered. It's also interesting to give another category that he lists there, which also has an example that we may not relate to necessarily in our world, but you can also perhaps extrapolate. He says that you shouldn't necessarily volunteer if the guy, let's say they're asking about a boy and he's not the greatest Torah scholar, he's not the greatest Talmud Chacham. He says you shouldn't necessarily volunteer that if they don't ask that straight out. Why not? Because if they really care about that, so her father can give him a farher, her father can give him a test. So again, that may not necessarily be a part of our world. We're not assuming that every girl who's dating her father is necessarily capable of giving an exam to the prospective suitor, or necessarily that's a part of their system overall. But it's an interesting assumption. You know, they say that there's a story that was related that the daughter of the Baruch Tam was going out, was dating the Kutzker, and he gave him a Faher, he gave him a Bechina to see if he knows how to learn. And then sometime later, he gave him another Faher. So after he gave him the second Bechina, so then the Kutzker said to the prospective father-in-law, to the Baruch Tam, he said, now I got to give you a Bechina. So he said, what's going on? So he explained, the Kutzker explained to him, he says, why is it that prospective father-in-laws give their prospective son-in-laws a Bechina? Because the Gemara says that you should try to marry your daughter off to a Talmud Chacham. But it also says you should try to marry the daughter of a Talmud Chacham. So how come you never find that son-in-laws test their future fathers-in-law? Because there's a concept of a chazaka that we assume that there's a presumption of the past that probably his father-in-law tested him and his father-in-law tested him, so we can rely on what happened in the past. We don't have to redo it again. But you tested me once, and now you're testing me a second time. So apparently you don't believe in the concept of chazaka. So if you don't believe in relying on what happened in the past, so then I have to test you again, because I can't rely on what happened in the past either. I can't rely on chazaka, so now I have to give you a bechina too. So the Baruch Tam said to him, he said, you're right, and you're also very chutzpahdik, so I don't think you should marry my daughter. So instead, he ended up marrying the daughter. I'm sorry, I said this wrong. This is the Avnei Nezer, excuse me, not the Kutzker. This was the Avnei Nezer who ended up marrying the daughter of the Kutzker. So it was a better personality match. And the story is interesting on a lot of levels, but it also indicates that there are a lot of different things people are looking for when they are looking for a Torah scholar as a son-in-law. But the whole notion of what the Chafetz Chaim is talking about here, whether or not we have the capacity to interview and to test our future prospective sons-in-law is not necessarily the point, but I think what can be extrapolated from here is, as far as the third party, is that if there is information that the principals could easily find out themselves, and they're not choosing to take the initiative to do so, so then you are not obligated to volunteer that information if it's not directly being asked of you, and it's something that they have other ways to find out, so then you're not obligated to volunteer. So perhaps that might apply, let's say, to things that are Googleable today, probably, because probably people routinely Google individuals who they are involved with. So if there's something that's out there that they could easily find out, and they're choosing not to, and they're asking you, so, and they're not asking you specifically, that might be an example of something which probably not required to volunteer, but again, every situation has its own variables. So just to say a little bit more about these kinds of general principles, so one of the very complicated areas are the questions of medical histories and medical realities, medical current medical situations. So just to mention a few of the principles that have been discussed in Poskim, but again, these are questions that are very sensitive and very circumstance dependent. So in every situation, really, there would be individual guidance that's necessary. But just to mention a few of the considerations that have been pointed out. So let's say Eliezer, for example, said that if somebody doesn't have the possibility of having any children, so then that's something that should be disclosed. But Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote, very interestingly, that if somebody has the condition that meant they would have fewer children, but would be able to have children, so then that's not of that same level. And that's an interesting position to take. There is a Sefer, which is not so well known, but it's just mentioned it because he has a number of interesting positions about these issues, called the Shuvas Berchas Reuven Shlomo, of Rav Baruch Reuven Shlomo Schlesinger, where he writes that if you have anything that somebody had in the past and that doesn't affect their lives now, so it's reasonable to expect that the spouse may never have to deal with, the spouse may never have to find out about, so that, he thinks, is not called a chisaron. And that he applies to a situation where somebody had a situation in the past and they're able to control with medications, and it's not, and as long as they do that, it's not going to recur. But something that is continuously going on, or could pose an ongoing threat to their lives, or has some kind of ongoing effect, would be a different story. Similarly, with Nissim Karelitz, in his writings on this, he emphasized that an illness that has receded but is likely to come back and is currently being addressed with medication, so that, he says, should be revealed unless the pills are only an extra precaution. So again, that's very subjective, whether it's something that's just an extra precaution or is more fundamental, and that's a part of the variabilities that you find in every situation. But he also gives us a principle that any condition that could interfere with Shalom Bayis should be disclosed. Moshe Sternbuch, in his Shuvas, so he writes that emotional and psychological problems should be revealed, but he writes as an exception, says if there's an issue that was in the past and has no current impact and was rooted in a cause that is no longer present and presents no risk of recurrence, as attested to by outstanding doctors renowned for their expertise. So again, here, these are just some of the variable considerations that you find discussed. Rav Meir Brandestoffer, so he has a tshuva in which he writes that if there's any lingering doubt about the recurrence of the condition, so then to conceal that would be deceptive. And he emphasizes the chiluk here, which is an important distinction that you find in Mamonos also, that there are things which are not necessarily serious enough to create a mekach taos, but still there's a chiv to reveal the chachil anyway, and that's important to also be aware of. Ramosha also has a tshuva where he talks about a condition which is called in his tshuva marpans, but the point here is, as far as statistical relevance, says that if there's a 50% chance that the children will have it too, says that's something that has to be revealed. Rav Nasha Klein has a tshuva where he emphasizes that where you have to certainly have to reveal somebody has a serious illness, but he says if the only implication of the illness is that you have to have a specific diet, that certain foods are going to be off limit, so he thought that that doesn't have to be revealed. And he also discusses in his shuvas, he says that if the rove of people, if most people are not makbid on living with somebody with such an illness, and you're not asked specifically about it, that you're not obligated to reveal. And there was an article about this in Tchumen, which was written by a married couple who are both doctors, Yoel and Chana Katan, and they also quote there from Rav Yitzchok Zilberstein, who mentions as a general policy that in talking about these things, that one should be megala tefach u'mechaset tefachayim, they should reveal a little bit, and then see how much the person involved cares and how much they want to know, and then if there's a sense they need to know more, then you reveal more proportionally based on how much of a sense of a kapada they have. So essentially, those issues of medical conditions are very, very sensitive and very variable based on the circumstances. But some of these basic principles in terms of how much is it going to affect the life of the spouse and how much will it affect the lives of the children of the spouse or the children of a potential family, these are some of the major considerations that the poskim factor in, and each situation has its own variables, but these are some of the principles that make a big difference in terms of these considerations. If the person being asked is a doctor, so then there are ethical considerations that come into play in terms of disclosure. The poskim talk about some additional considerations that apply to doctors. The fact that the doctor takes an oath, does that make a difference? So, first of all, is that considered to be a specific promise not to reveal such information? Is that halachically binding? Rav Zilberstein had an essay about that. Is it considered maybe to be a shvua levatel a samitzvah? Because here, if you have an obligation of lo samad al dam riacha, so then maybe you should say that the shvua shouldn't take effect because this is canceling out that particular obligation. So he goes back and forth about whether there is such a possible concern there also. Should you say also that maybe there's an issue of gezel, that maybe the doctor is paid on condition that he won't reveal any conditions? And he writes that deep down he doesn't think that that's actually the assumption, because deep down there's a general belief that this is what people want, that they want to know what's best for them. He also discusses, as do others, whether Rav Ariel has a tshuva about this and a tshuva spoholo shel Torah, that maybe it's also a legitimate concern for a doctor to say that if I reveal what I'm told by one patient, so then no other patient's going to come to me and I'm not going to be able to help anyone. So he notes, he thinks that is a legitimate concern. So these are also a part of the complicated cheshbonos that are already complicated enough for anybody, but once you're a doctor, so then that has extra weight and that becomes a added complication that has to be weighed in terms of every aspect of this. There's also the question, just to throw in one other element into the mix, that what if the doctor is potentially going to lose his job? So is there a issue of lo samad al dam riacha that outweighs even losing all your parnassa? So that's also something that the poskim talk about, that the Rav Ariel talks about in the tshuva bo lo shel Torah, and Rav Nachum Barbanovich has a tshuva about, that Tzitz Eliezer has a tshuva about. So all of these are considerations that are too weighty to try to give one big principle about, but just a call to one's attention just how serious some of these considerations are, and to be aware of some of the cheshbonos that go into them. Just to go back for a moment to some of the more general Lashon Hara considerations, so the Chafetz Chaim had a cheshbon that others didn't necessarily agree with, that he thought that when you ask about a shidduch, so you have to tell the person you're asking that it's for that purpose, because even if you are justified in asking because of the toelis, if the person answering doesn't realize this latoelis, so then it's possible they would be violating Lashon Hara even though it otherwise is justified. And others thought that that didn't necessarily follow, that if it's justified by toelis, so then it doesn't matter what the kavanah of the answerer is. You don't have to necessarily worry that you're being machshel them that by the fact that they're not aware that it's done latoelis, which has interesting lamdisha implications. He also assumes that you can ask people about whatever they want, and you can ask whatever you want to know about, and you can ask as many people as you want, and that you're justified as far as that's concerned. It's an interesting question, though, in terms of if you are the person responding and you feel that the information is irrelevant, or if you were asked, if you were told something in confidence. So does that mean just because the person is entitled to ask whatever they want to ask, and the Chafetz Chaim says that, does that mean that you are entitled to reveal something in confidence, especially if your assessment is that it is irrelevant and that it would constitute, let's say, a breach of privacy in the general sense or in a specific ethical context, or it would constitute Lashon Hara? So Rabbi Avadya Yosef writes that one theoretically could give a deceptive response and that it was in the category of Mutter Lashanus with Nehashalom. So personally, I would think that would be very dangerous policy-wise, and that even if it was strictly speaking Mutter Alpidin, that could really get one in very serious trouble, and it's probably highly inadvisable as a matter of policy. But I think it's more practical for a person just to avoid answering the question. I don't think it's wise to mislead, but a person does have the right to avoid the question and say that if the person thinks that they don't have an obligation to prevent harm in such a situation, if they don't think that the information is relevant to preventing harm, if it's not a situation of Lo Samar al Dam Re'acha, and the question they're being asked involves a breach of privacy or a possible Lashon Hara, so then to say they don't know the answer to the question, which wouldn't actually mislead the other party, but would still protect the privacy of the person who they're being asked about, so that presumably would be a different story. And that may be the preferable approach in such a situation. So the position that the Chafetz Chaim is expressing here, that otherwise the person has the right to, the one asking has the right to ask whatever they want and to get whatever questions answered. So if the justification is Lo Samar al Dam Re'acha, so that's a little bit hard to understand, as some of the later Sfarim ask, because if it's Lo Samar al Dam Re'acha, so then Miman of Shach, so then it shouldn't matter whether they ask, because you should be obligated to reveal even without being asked, if it's really Lo Samar al Dam Re'acha. And if it's not Lo Samar al Dam Re'acha, so then it shouldn't matter whether they ask or not. So how does the person asking affect the equation? It's either Lo Samar al Dam Re'acha or not. So if it is, so then this should be something you should reveal without them asking. And if it isn't, so then it shouldn't be okay to answer even when you are asked. So some explain that there are things that are in the gray zone, that are in the Suffolk territory. So they only become clear that they affect the marriage once the person asks about them. And then until the person asks about these things, so then it's not clear that they're going to have any impact on the marriage. So it's not clear that there's any kind of Lo Samar al Dam Re'acha potential there. But once the person says that I care about this, and this is the kind of thing that will interfere with the possibility of there being a happy marriage, so then Lo Samar al Dam Re'acha applies. So what that also indicates is that Lo Samar al Dam Re'acha is being applied here on a couple of levels. There is the major kind of Lo Samar al Dam Re'acha, that if somebody is actually dangerous, somebody is potentially posing a threat in a relationship, so then that's a very objective kind of Lo Samar al Dam Re'acha, and that has to be revealed up front without any kind of need to wait for an inquiry. But then there's also a more specific type of Lo Samar al Dam Re'acha to save somebody from a incompatible relationship, and that often that you won't know until the individual tells you what they consider to be incompatible, what they feel they will find hurtful in a relationship or find problematic for them to be able to be in a relationship with. And once they tell you that, so then you will know and you'll be able to respond in a helpful way. Of course, very often people don't know themselves what they will be able to live with in a relationship, and that's also a part of the evolving and maturing that people often do in the context of dating, and to whatever extent a third party is able to help with that and to gently nudge the questioner into a healthier space, so then very often that is equally helpful and equally constructive to answering the questions that they are actually asking, and that also requires wisdom and discretion and insight as much as anything else. It's also important to know who to ask, that very often people turn to with their questions about asking about potential shiduchim. They ask just whoever happens to be in their circle. It's what we call the availability bias, that there is an assumption that people find that the information that they have access to is necessarily the best information. But there's no reason to think that. So if somebody suggests a shidduch to you, and the shidduch lives, the person lives in a certain town, and you only know one person in that town, so you assume that person must know this individual very well just because they live in the same town. But it's not necessarily true. They're just the only person you know in that town. So that's often a bad source of information, but we have this tendency to believe that whatever source we have for information is the best source of information, and often that can be misleading. Also, there are people who aren't objective, and if you ask somebody who, for example, dated this person in the past, so it may be that their perspective is skewed. Maybe that they have an unfairly negative view of the person, or it could be that maybe they're hoping that they'll come back to date this person, so maybe that may impact how they view the possibility of this relationship being successful. So there are all kinds of other biases that could get in the way of a straight answer or of a helpful answer. So this also applies to the one asking the question, to make sure that when they ask the question and who they ask the question to, that they do so in a productive way. And that's also a part of the considerations that come up when these discussions happen. We'll just close by noting that there was a question that the Achronim asked that, okay, so we've established clearly that anything that could impact the decision whether to go ahead with a marriage or not, so for sure that has to be disclosed. And that in the most extreme situation, failing to disclose something of that level, that could lead to a mekach tos, that could lead to a decision that could be even nullified. But even without reaching that level, it would be a very serious avera of ona, of bringing somebody into a relationship under false pretenses. But you could ask that maybe even information that's less significant than that. So maybe you should have to disclose everything that's less than perfect, because if we look to the parallel of the business world, so if I sell you an item and it's not worth as much as I claim that it is, so that's ona. So if I sell you a car and I tell you it's worth $10,000, and I sell it to you for that, but it's really worth only $5,000. So that's ona, that's fraud. But if I sell it to you for the right price, but I tell you that you're getting a better deal than you actually are, I let you think that it's more perfect than it really is, so then that's not fraud, but that's a different prohibition. That's what we call gneivas das, that is deception, and that's also prohibited. So based on that, there were those who asked the question, so how come when you're dating, maybe you should be obligated to reveal every flaw, every imperfection that you have, because even if it doesn't rise to the level of something that would impact the marriage taking place, but maybe it's still gneivas das potentially. Maybe it's still something that would meet the standard of deception, and maybe that should be a prohibition. So there are a number of answers that are given. One answer was suggested by the Klausenberger Rebbe in his Tshuvas Divrei Yatziv, where he said it's basically just a matter of policies, that it's like a takanas hashuk, that it's essentially a policy that we make, that yes, you might be right logically, but if you were to take such a policy that everyone has to disclose every flaw of any level, so then nobody would ever get married. And we assume that people want to get married, and that cannot be a workable policy, so we assume that people entering the dating marketplace essentially are mochel. They waive that right to get complete full disclosure. And if it's not the kind of thing that rises to that level, that it would actually impact the decision process, so then there's no need and we don't recommend disclosure on that level. And another answer was suggested by the Stipler in his Sefer on Yevamos, where he drew the following comparison. He said, let's say that if you want to continue the comparison to the business world, so let's say I sell you a car, and I tell you that this car has, I sell it to you for the right price, but I also tell you that this car has a wonderful extra feature that as soon as you drive the car, it right away plays Wayu Torah automatically without you having to do anything. So then you buy the car for the right price, but it turns out it doesn't have that extra feature. Okay, so you're not going to return the car because you still paid the right price for it, so it's not an invalid sale. So fine, it doesn't have that feature, but it is what it is. But let's say the dealer calls you back the next day and says, oh, I'm sorry, I feel bad. I accidentally sold you the car that doesn't have the special Wayu Torah feature. So I'll come back and I'll give you the car that does have the exact same model that you bought, but that does have the Wayu Torah feature. So will you accept the exchange? Probably. Why not? Now let's carry that over to marriage. So let's say I'm a shadchan and I suggest a girl to you and you marry her. And you're happily married. Along the way, you discover some things you didn't know about, but doesn't matter. You're still happily married all this time. And after your 25th anniversary, I call you up and I say, listen, I know you've been happily married for 25 years, but I feel bad that I never told you about these little quirks that you discovered later on. So here's what I'm going to do. I have this other woman who's exactly like your wife, and I'll bring her over and we'll trade, and she just doesn't have those quirks, and I'll trade her for your wife. So what do you say? Will you take the deal? What's the right answer to that question? Is it yes or no? So the right answer to that question is neither yes nor no. The right answer is that's a ridiculous question. The whole scenario doesn't make sense. Human beings are not interchangeable that way. The whole scenario is crazy, and there's no such thing as saying, oh, there's another person out there who's exactly like your wife, but you can just change this one quirk and everything else will be the exact same. So the notion that you can compare this to that level to a business transaction, it falls apart at that level. And there is a Musar Haskel, presumably, that emerges from these two answers, that on some level, yes, there is a necessary parallel between dating and marriage and a business transaction, and we do start from that premise, but to take it too far is going to be unhelpful. And whether it's the Klausenberger's point that no one's ever going to get married if we come with the perspective that it's business-like to such a degree, or that the observation of the Stipler that taking it to such an extent that you really compare it to a business transaction for all intents and purposes and you see marriage as merchandise. So anyone who comes with that kind of attitude is not going to find happiness, but to recognize that people are unique by definition and they're not interchangeable, and that yes, there is a comparison to the business world that goes only so far, and that does indicate that you're entering into an agreement between two people that requires honesty and integrity and openness and disclosure. So to that extent, there is a comparison. But beyond that, to recognize that people are not merchandise and that everyone is unique, and that if you want to find happiness and you want the Tu B'Av to have its full meaning, to fully appreciate that and recognize that is perhaps the first step. So everyone should be zoche to have the happiest day of the year, one of the two happiest days of the year, fully express itself upon all of Klal Yisrael, and we should be zoche to only good things. And Mirtz Hashem, next week we'll talk about something else. Thank you very much. Shkayach.